Welcome back, everybody, to Beer Garden Tennis. My name's Josh, and I'm here with the Culf Man. How you going, Culfy?
Yeah, good, Josh. Good to be back. Ready to rock and roll.
So we're well and truly into the clay court season now, and just some of the results are expected. There's a lot of stuff that's unexpected. Well, maybe not so much to people that are watching regularly, but to the everyday, more casual audience that's just trying to get across who a lot of these people are leading up to the French Open. There's been a few people recently that have maybe potentially come out of nowhere with form or big games, and a few people that have come back with a bit of form that we weren't expecting to. So we're going to get on to all of that today. In part one of a two-parter today, we're going to cover off just a little bit of what we didn't get to in the last episode, including what happened in Barcelona. And then we're going to talk about a few of the big results from what's been happening this week on the clay. And then in part two, we're actually going to talk about some of the up-and-comers and some of the people you maybe aren't as familiar with that are looking like they've got a shot come next week in Rome and then the French. So let's just kick off, Culfy. Casper Ruud won after, I don't know if I made it sound like I'd lost faith in him or not, but I love the guy. He won Barcelona, got his revenge on Tsitsipas. What did you think about his game v. Tsitsipas there versus earlier in Monte Carlo where he actually lost the final? So it's kind of a bit of a reverse in result.
Yeah, absolute reversal for sure. And one that's, well, you know, obviously going into that final, it was like, okay, how's he going to turn this around? Because he was basically dismantled, the week before in that big final there. And look, both those guys really to back up from the week before, that's something that we spoke about is, you know, who are going to be the guys that really separate themselves this clay court season? Well, there's two right there. You know, Ruud, who, you know, we've said that he hasn't been able to get back to those heights from about 18 months ago. And look, it's so tough to maintain that level unless you're one of those guys like a Novak or a Nadal at, you know, peak time. But, you know, to see Ruud turn that around, probably more of a mental gain for him than probably, you know, physical. He looked a little bit tired in that final the week before, and, you know, Tsitsipas was just able to dictate with the forehand and just bully him, basically. So for him to turn that around and for Stefanos to make the final again, you know, we spoke about his lack of, I guess, for lack of a better way to describe it, being a little bit distracted, you know, so having, you know, one hot week and then losing a couple of first rounds or a second round, you know, he's been able to maintain his ranking because, you know, he has two or three week periods like this where he's winning a 1,000, where he's making another final the week after. You know, so his biggest challenge now is, okay, am I able to sustain that over the next 3-4 weeks? We know the clay court season, you know, doesn't hold up. We're currently in Madrid right now. It moves on to Rome straight away. We were just talking about that. Yeah. It's like it's a brutal schedule. Straight into Rome, another 1,000.
Well, there's more than four happening, but some of these guys are playing four consecutively in 4 weeks.
Yep. And Novak not playing this week. He's put his hand up he's going to be waiting for these guys in Rome. He needs to get some matches under the belt before the French Open. But to answer your question, yeah, big turnaround from Ruud there to get that clay court title. He's kind of been, over the last couple of seasons, he's been the real master on the clay at those, you know, those smaller events, those 250s, those 500s, where he's just cleaning up when he's playing his best tennis. So not surprising to see him, you know, go back-to-back finals, splitting those two finals with Tsitsipas. I think both guys and both coaching teams, they've got to be pretty happy with that. They would have taken that going into Monte Carlo and then going into Barcelona. If you were to pull them aside and say, hey, how would you feel about, you know, a title and a runner-up over the next 2 weeks? They would have signed the paper right there. So both guys pretty happy over those 2 weeks. The question is coming into Madrid about those petrol tickets that we speak about.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, can you, the only guy that we've really been able to see sustain this over the journey has been that brute Nadal, you know what I mean? Really? Yeah. And peak Novak. Other than that, so hard to continually make finals on the clay court during the clay court season.
And I've now watched the final from Barcelona in full, and also I've watched the highlights. And there was a couple of things that stood out to me that Ruud did adjust versus the previous week. And it did come across maybe that there was a little bit of a flip in energy level, because I didn't actually go and look at the ball speeds, but just visually it looked like there wasn't quite as much power on Tsitsipas's forehand. And whether the conditions were different and he was maybe going for more spin or something, or just trying to put different shape on the ball, it didn't seem like the conditions were different enough for there to be that big a drop in power. But what really stood out was how much more easily Casper Ruud handled the power. He actually at times was overpowering Tsitsipas and just loading up on that forehand.
Mm.
And whether in the game before that he was maybe expecting it to draw out and be more brutal and he was conserving some energy because he didn't have the huge forehands that we've come to expect that Casper somehow produces.
Mm.
But he certainly had that going. The thing that mostly stood out to me was he just seemed to have more faith in his backhand and just pounded it if he needed to. And he was running around to the forehand when he really felt like he could load up, but he just had more variation just in across his whole game. It wasn't the single-minded Casper game plan, which I've seen him fall into in the past, even in big matches where he was well down and he needed to change. French Open final versus Novak, he didn't really make any tactical adjustments. And then he lost in three sets, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
He made some tactical adjustments from that final, and Tsitsipas then in turn failed to adjust back to that. But it was really, to me, it just seemed like one guy had it going at a really high level, and maybe something Casper doesn't always do where he can ramp it up during a match. He really did that in the Barcelona final, and Tsitsipas didn't really have an answer for it.
Yep. I don't know how many conversations I have with people that are just great points that you make there, Josh. People who are just amazed at, you know, why is this guy so successful at this tournament yet he can't win a round at this event? Or, you know, why is this guy, every time he performs at this event or, you know, he signs up at this tournament, you know, he stinks. He never makes the finals, you know what I mean? Well, there's certain things that are called, you know, comfort zones, and athletes and players like certain cities, and some other athletes and players don't like other cities.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Hence why, you know, they get a choice to where they want to play, you know, week in, week out. Now, yes, some of the 1,000s, they stand alone by themselves, so they go and play those events. Great example is Tsitsipas. He's won, you know, Monte Carlo three times.
Yeah.
You know, it's his most successful Masters 1000 by a long way, and it just happens to be on clay. Loves the conditions there. Loves the, you know, the environment. You know, so that comes into the equation for sure. Then you've got, you know, those adjustments that players have to make. And if you're playing the same guy in the final a week later, you better believe, and you've had your butt kicked the week before in that first final, yeah, you're going to make adjustments. That team needs to say, how do we flip the script here? You know what I mean? Not only, you know, mentally and physically, but tactically. And that exactly what you said. And how do they do that? Both those guys, Stefanos and Casper, they want to dictate with the forehand and they want to dictate early. They want to run around the backhand. They want to upgrade and they want to go big. First of all, you've got to have the courage to do that,
yeah,
you know, and not just sit back here and, hey, I'm just going to rally and see what transpires. You got to go big and you got to go early when that ball's there. And Casper, you know, that 18 months ago when he was making, you know, those slam finals, and, you know, a slam final on a hard court is different to a slam final on his favorite surface, which is the dirt, which is the clay.
Yeah.
He was hitting the forehand as big as ever. His forehand was probably, you know, went from just your standard kind of ATP tour forehand to, you know, top five on tour in terms of, you know, RPMs. So, you know, that's when he's doing that, you know, on the dirt, especially, you know, he's right there and he's going to win titles, especially the 250s and the 500s. And as we've seen, 1,000 events on the clay and slam events on the clay, you know, so he's right there. And it's only the very best performances in those finals that deny him the trophy. So the adjustments were made and it was like, hey, we're going to go bigger off the forehand. We're going to do it earlier. And we need to stop Stefanos from dictating and running around. And he was able to keep him on the back foot and win the title.
Absolutely. He was pushing him back much more. The cross-court forehand when he was on the move had much more penetration. And we talked about before that of all of the talents that Tsitsipas has, where you'd probably rank him nearly above anyone, is his net game. It's just beautiful. He's got every shot at the net. He never seems out of control. It's always got the perfect amount of placement. And that was a part of the game that Casper denied Tsitsipas that he wasn't denying him so much in the previous game, just pushing him back when he really needed to. And I was really impressed. But the thing is, sometimes I just doubt that Casper's going to ramp it up. I sit there hoping, because as I've said, I'm a fan of him. I love his game and I love how unassuming he is. He's almost like the forgotten top tenner sometimes because you forget that he's even in the mix. But he did ramp it up to a level of power that puts him right. I mean, I'm not going to say it's Sinner Alcaraz or Novak in Australia or any like a level of power to that level, but it was enough of a jump between the two games that Tsitsipas didn't really have an answer for it, particularly in the second set.
Yeah, and come those finals, you know, when you're playing, you're not playing, if you're making a Masters 1000 final, generally looking at playing a guy around that top five, top 10 really area. You know, we're not seeing very often guys outside that area being accustomed to making these 1000 finals. You know, it's normally guys top tier, top elite level. And unless you're one of these youngsters, like such as an Alcaraz or, you know, let's just say an FAA when he was sort of coming through that, you know, you go, well, I could see them making, you know, a 1000 final here or taking a title, you know? So, you know, you're talking about like, you better bring your A game and your very, very best. Otherwise you're going to be, you know, taking the runner-up trophy. And Casper knows that I have that level. You know, I mean, I have that level. I haven't been able to consistently match that level for 18 months, but it's there. Yeah. You know what I mean? And, you know, he was bullied the week before, and full credit to him for you know, obviously the belief level is like, look, it's there. I know it is. I've just got to get on the front foot. And he was able to do that. And it's got to give him, you know, heaps of confidence going into, you know, the French Open coming up. Rome, you'd assume he's going to play Rome as well. He's playing in Madrid this week. More on that when we cover Madrid. But, you know, as I said, three solid weeks now, you know, two finals and a title. You know, as we're going to speak more about, as we know, we tell the home viewer, you know, coming into Madrid as well, you know, you've got to question that physical, does he need a physical break or a mental break and how's his form going to go? But, you know, hey, he's put himself right back in the mix because, as you said, he's one of those guys out there that little fanfare, very disciplined, professional as they come, has a really good team around him. You know, being Norwegian, that part of the world, they're very respectful, very quiet, and he just goes about his business. And he thoroughly deserved getting that title there.
Excellent. And we'll just finish up with he hit two backhands down the line that were as beautiful as any shot I've seen him hit in that second set. And they weren't just mid-game sort of rally where maybe didn't swing the game at all. One of them was as picture perfect a backhand down the line as you would see from a bit of an awkward position. It looked like a shot that he shouldn't have been able to hit, and he hit it effortlessly. And it was, well, it felt to me at least watching the game like, oh, he's got this. An early nail in the coffin sort of shot that he's just playing at a different level. And that's not something that I always see in his game where you're like, oh, no one else could hit that shot.
Yep.
Like you see it sometimes with Alcaraz or Sinner gets to a ball you don't expect or Novak's landing the ball a millimeter from the baseline consecutively in a point. Like Casper has those things in him. He just it's starting to come out more.
Yep, that's again. Right. That's right. And he actually did that when he made the that US Open final there. He was hitting that two-hand backhand up the line, and it was just like he was winning the majority of his points from the back of the court. His baseline game went to a whole new level, you know, with the heat off the ground and, you know, the RPMs off the deck.
Yeah.
But that was one thing that stood out was the courage and the bravery to go line on the backhand or the two-hander. And it just completely caught guys off guard because, you know, he was a guy that, you know, 95% of the time I'm going to roll cross, I'm going to be patient, and I'm going to look to hit the forehand.
Grind.
Yeah, but he rolled cross, and then it was like he was hitting flat backhands up the line. When he's hitting that shot, you know, combined with, you know, that forehand, you know, at top speeds, you know, he's top five player, you know, and he's a threat to win a French Open if he can do that for 2 weeks.
Yeah. So we'll see how that plays out. Obviously, this is all dependent on how he gets through these next few tournaments, if he chooses to play Rome and just how his body's feeling. But as you've said, he looks about as fit and as disciplined as any player out there. So one big thing, obviously, that's happened this week is Nadal had a bit of a run, and we want to talk about how how that kind of culminated in the most recent game versus Lehechka, but how are you feeling about what you'd seen from Nadal and maybe from two perspectives, Kolfman, both his actual game on the court, but how did it make you feel as a tennis fan that he was there for a portion of the week?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was great. Just, you know, in Madrid, in his home, you know, well, you know, basically his home tournament, you know what I mean? He says it's his favourite event all year to play at home. Obviously, outside of the French Open, where he's had so much success, but obviously he's dominated Madrid over the journey as well. He's dominated all these clay court events.
Yeah.
So, you know, just to see him out there getting some matches in and some good wins as well. You know, took out, you know, Dimonar, who dismantled him the week before. So when that draw came out, he would have been, oh, well, somewhat a little bit nervous if you lose to a guy one week and you look at the draw and go, oh, geez, I've got him early the next week. But, you know, he was able to, his body, you know, he was able to, you know, to get through that match and, you know, play a level high enough that the next one was, I think it was against, you know, we talk about Argentinian guys, you know, they're as dangerous as any out there. And cash in, it was like a 3-hour match, you know what I mean, on the time clock, won that in three sets as well. So just for him to get through and win some main draw matches there and for the crowd to get behind him, mate, brilliant. Great stuff, you know, for all the fans out there, but also, you know, from where I was sitting, I was like, oh, that was just great to see because, that, as we know, once players are, once they're done, you know, they're done. So, you know, the appreciation meter for what these guys have done in the sport and actually to see them out there competing, you know, was just great to see. So, yeah, very, very enjoyable.
I loved watching it and I loved seeing him. There was flashes of him at his best. It was never going to be a case of we're going to watch him completely steamroll people, but there were periods of each game in the first two rounds where he did do that.
Mm.
He just looked untouchable for periods of the game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess as you get older, your ability to do that for an entire match maybe decreases. But that part of it was brilliant. What was going on the court, there were periods where he was hitting all the shots. He was getting to where he wanted to. He didn't look like he was uncomfortable when he was stretching for different balls, whereas in the previous match, I thought that Nadal's never going to let a ball go.
Mm.
He's never going to go, oh, no. I mean, unless it's completely unplayable, but he's never going to just hold back thinking, I'm not going to even bother with that one. So there was always that worry in the back of my head, is he going to push himself in the way only Nadal would push himself then possibly get hurt or go out early because the injury becomes maybe a bit more of a niggle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he looked comfortable chasing down balls. And he ran into Lehechka, Jiří Lehechka, which we've talked about. And I can't believe he didn't come up when we were trying to describe our perfect athlete for a tennis player because he's one of the top athletes, in my opinion, out of the new crop.
Yep.
And he's having a pretty good run quietly behind the scenes. He's probably not a big name, but he's making it a decent amount into a lot of tournaments, like a fair way in.
Yep.
And I don't know if you had a chance to watch the Nadal-Lehechka highlights or the game itself, but it was a rare game of both power and finesse from Lehechka, which I haven't seen him put together that many times. He normally has either the touch around the net and he's a bit loose, or he's just brutalizing the ball, but he's lacking a bit of touch. Whereas in that game, he would have beaten most people, not just Nadal, I think, overnight.
Yeah, with these Czech players, I mean, there's just something about the way they hit the ball that just seems heavier than everybody else. You know what I mean? He's not the only one. There's a couple of guys, you know, younger than him from, you know, the Czech Republic that they just bludgeon the ball, you know, huge rips. And it's just like you're taking body blow after body blow. And, you know, Lehechka, since coming on tour, you know, he won his maiden title this year in Australia before the Australian Open. And he was just, just brutalizing the ball and, you know, hitting it huge on the hard courts there. And, you know, but we've also seen Lehechka, you know, play some howlers where the ball's just, you can't control the ball. You know, it's hitting, it's not literally hitting back fences, but that's what it seems like. It's just the ball's, you know, a meter out and then the timing's not there. But when the timing's there, you know, it's top 10 stuff. And I think it's only a matter of time before, you know, he knocks on that door of the top 10. It's just those consistent results that is the next step for him. And now we're starting to see that. And I guess for Lehechka, the pleasing thing is this week, you know, in Madrid, you know, this is taking place, you know, on a clay court. Now, you know, he prefers a hard court.
Yeah.
But he's getting some results here, some, you know, some good wins. And that match against Nadal, that's not an easy match.
No, it was 7-5, 6-4.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a walkover and he got pushed.
Yeah, he got pushed, and it's not an easy match, especially mentally.
No.
Where you go, geez, I've got the whole country against me.
Yeah.
Here.
And Nadal had a few quintessential, only Rafa Nadal could have won that point. And the celebration that followed.
Oh, yeah.
Where the momentum felt like it could have fully turned in Nadal's favour.
Mm. So it was a real mental positive step for someone where Lehechka sits in terms of his you know, career journey or career path right now, where it's like, well, geez, that was always going to be a mental challenge, both, you know, before the match and then once you're in the match, during the match. So he can tick that box and he's got to feel pretty good. That, man, you know, that was tough. You know what I mean? I've got the whole stadium against me. You know, I've got Nadal, you know, on a clay court. Yeah, you would have been maybe 12 months ago, 18 months ago. It was probably a match where, you know, if he was to lose that match in at the same scoreline, you'd go, oh, well, that's probably to be expected. It was probably a little bit overwhelming for him, you know.
Yeah.
But that's big growth for Lehechka. And there's no question that, you know, he's going to be a top 10 player. You know, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
No.
He's just, his firepower is scary.
It's crazy.
Yeah, the forehands, you know, the forehands are the highest level.
Yeah.
And, yeah, when you're talking about, you know, I don't know what goes on over there, what they feed their children over there in the Czech Republic, if it's something in the diet, something in the water. But, you know, they're in the Thomas Berdych mold when he exploded onto the scene as well.
Yeah.
You know, as an 18, 19-year-old making, I think he may have made a 1,000 final or may have won the title as a 19-year-old, Berdych, you know. And we know what an amazing career he had. He was competing at the, you know, in the Grand Slam finals and, you know, with all those guys, with the Federers and Nadals. So Lehechka's a little bit in that mold, you know, about 6'4", just huge legs, explosive legs. You know, can bomb the serve. It's all there. So, you know, he's just another one. They just keep churning them out. And we're going to get onto it, you know, in some future shows on some of these other guys from the Czech Republic who are a couple of years, 2 or 3 years younger than him, that are screaming their way towards the top 20 as well.
Yeah.
So Czech Republic, man, amazing.
When I saw how well Lehechka was playing and then I saw that his ranking is 30, I'm like, that's as complete a game as I've seen anyone play in a while, with the pressure of you're playing against the greatest player ever on a single surface in his home country, basically his home tournament. To do all that and to only be 30 with that level of game means that you are having some pretty poor results at times as well, because to me he looked as good as other players that are already top 20, probably top 15. I mean, you can't take too much context out of one game, but he had everything pushing against him on the court and off the court, and he still looked unaffected by it.
Yeah, and, you know, you see guys like Lehechka, as you said, even if you're not actually observing or watching some of these matches, you know, if you're just checking the results, you know, you know, you see a match like that where he takes Nadal down under all that heat and pressure, in one of the biggest events on the calendar, you know, Masters 1000 level. And then you look at some of the results and, you know, down the track, and you look and go, how does he lose that first round match there at 250 level after, you know? But that's where he's at right now in his career. As you said, you know, his week in, week out performances warrant, you know, that top 30 ranking somewhere in, you know, around about that mark. But his level, when he's playing at his absolute best, you know, it's top 10 minimum, you know what I mean? It's almost top five, where you're getting into that, you know, that cream of the crop kind of stuff. And that's what's there for him. The challenge now is, you know, having that coaching staff and that team around him and that belief level, that's a huge tick in the belief box for Lehechka, where he goes, well, hang on a minute. Hey, if I can win in that environment, you know, Nadal, you know what I mean? He still won some main draw matches, and, you know, that the match against Cashin before, that was the concern. It went 3 hours and 5 minutes. That was always going to be the problem for Nadal, you know, come, you know, the business end of the event where he got to. He'll take that though. He's like, hey, if I can make the business end of this Madrid event, great. I can win some main draw matches. I can beat Dimonar, you know, top 10 player. Fantastic. So a tick in the box for Nadal, but that Lehecka belief meter, that's a big step to where he goes, okay, well, if I can handle that environment, I can handle these other environments moving forward. And, you know, before you know it, I'm going to be top 20. And hey, let's set a goal for maybe top 10 at the end of the year. So the year's not even halfway through. So yeah, Lehecka, he's one that you're going to see. But when he's playing, you know, that that style of tennis, that huge game, it just jumps off the page where you go, man, how is this guy 30? How is this guy 30?
Yeah.
You know,
I think a lot of it's the unforced error count. Sometimes it's out of control and other times he's got it landing on a pin.
Yeah. So and he's one of those players that, you know, when he's out there, you know it's going to be entertaining because it's just a big game, big athlete who moves incredibly well. And the thing is with some of the players there on tour, it's generally a quick day at the office. Yeah. He's either, you know, just punching forehands corner to corner and you're chasing balls down or, you know, he's spraying balls.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he dictates. It's always on his racket. He's one of those guys. But these Czech guys, these guys in the Czech Republic, you know, it's their style. It's what they do. And some of these younger boys play exactly the same way. And it's straight out of the Burdich textbook.
Yeah, as it should be. Mm. So we might finish up part one today talking about someone else that, at least in terms of being able to brutalize a ball and being a big, strong athlete and get around the court, Felix, in terms of loading it up and having a game that's just hard to deal with when it's at its best, we haven't seen that in a while from Felix, but he did have a pretty big result overnight. So he actually beat Casper Ruud. I'm not sure who was expecting that result. I mean, maybe if you said, oh, well, in a bubble, whose game is bigger and who's got the harder to deal with game, you'd probably say Felix, but Casper's obviously just won a tournament and made the final of another tournament, and he's a clay courter. How do you feel about that result? Was that one that you were expecting? And do you think that this is a blip, or do we think that Felix might have found something with a result like that?
Well, I think he may have found something, you know, and for Felix to go from, you know, where he's been, in, you know, a top 10 player, and I guess that path to, you know, a top five player, he hasn't handled the expectations that well, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
23 years of age now, you know, he's sitting at 35 in the world, okay? So coming into, you know, the clay court season, he's not one where you go, oh, I really expect him to, you know, win some of these 250s and, you know, make semis of the 1000s. No, not at all. Clay's not definitely results-wise. Clay's not his finest surface. It's definitely, you know, a hard court surface where, you know, he's gone on runs where he's won, you know, 3 250 events in a row. So he's similar in those 250 style events as Casper is on the clay courts that we've seen. You know, Casper playing these 250 events and he's the top seed. You know, he's taken the title. You know, really, unless there's an upset in there or he's making the final. So, you know, the consistent results from Casper on the dirt, that's what we were getting from Felix there 18 months ago. But the question was, you know, from the media was still, okay, when are we going to see that at 1,000 level? You know what I mean? And he wasn't able to make that push. You know, them injuries, you know, some niggles, you know, okay, had some injury worries. Then mentally, you know, he falls off the wagon a little bit. And that's when you find yourself back at that 30 in the world, 40 in the world. And before you know it, FAA's there going like, what the heck's going on? This is not how it's supposed to go. You know, regardless of how athletic and the you know, what he has access to in terms of his overall, you know, power package and, you know, his overall game. So then the decision really comes down to the athlete. It's like, okay, how do I get back to where I was? And that requires a lot of bloody energy, a lot of energy. We spoke about it with Grigor the other week. You know, the energy that it took for him to go from where he was at, sitting at like 50 or 60 in the world, where you go, how the heck is this guy sitting back here? Is he just comfortable, or what's the go here? You know what I mean? Is he lacking the motivation? You know, well, he answers that question and, you know, blasts his way back into the top 10, which is great. We love that. You know, huge from Dimitrov. So, you know, so in terms of you know, Felix coming in the clay court season. Look, he barely got through Nishioka in round one.
Yeah.
Barely. You know what I mean? He's 6-4 in the third set. You know, we know Nishioka's a pain in the backside to play. You know what I mean? He just makes a lot of balls and he's, you know, he's crafty and, you know, you're out there for a long day, I guess, at the office. But he barely got through there. And then, you know, you look moving forward, took out Mannarino. Mannarino's sort of fallen off a little bit, you know, since January, since his fourth round at the Aussie Open. But then, you know, he comes up against Ruud, and yeah, it's a surprise because you look at the results coming in and, you know, Ruud on a clay court. And, you know, so watching that match, you know, absolutely. But he was able to get the job done there, which is, it just shows that he's, you know, he's like, hey, don't forget about me. It's one of those events. You know what I mean? Hey, don't forget about me. I'm still trying to figure this out. You know what I mean? I'm still here. You know, in terms of that match, Ruud, he looked a little bit fatigued. You know, he had a great win against Norrie. That's Ruud the round before. So, yeah, must have been feeling okay there. You know, Norrie's a very competent clay court player. You know, arguably probably his most favorite surface, I think. You know, he's had some incredible results on the clay. But, you know, Felix just bullied Casper around the court, and it was just a bit of a reminder of, hey, you know, my athleticism, it's still top tier. My forehand when it's on, still top tier. My serve, I crack that thing.
Yeah,
when I'm feeling confident, you know what I mean? And my backhand's it's solid enough where I can rally balls back consistently until I can upgrade to the forehand. You know, net game, you know, it's probably, look, let's be honest, it's not top tier, but great win overnight. He plays, I think it's Sinner, is it? Next round? I think it may be. I think, let me just check there. Quarterfinal of, you know, of Madrid. Question is he happy with that? Or does he go, you know what? Hey, here's my chance. This guy, Sinner's the hottest player in the world. Let me take him down and let everybody know that, hey, don't forget about me.
So hopefully people don't forget about us. They come back and check us out in part two. So we're going to be talking about what it's like for these athletes that are coming back, that they're in tournaments and maybe they're not expected to win, where they get that motivation from. I'd love to talk to you, Kulfi, more about that with, say, a Felix. How does he keep pushing when maybe he's not expected to win? We're also going to talk about Jean-Leonard Struff, who has just had a fortnight of his life, and that'll also touch on Alcaraz. And we're going to be talking about maybe some of these challenger players and some of the real young next gen guys that you've got your eye on. I think there's one in particular you want to talk about. So that'll be in part two. Thank you for listening, guys. Share the show around to your tennis fan mates. Let them know that there's something good happening here. If you believe that that's what's happening, we'd really appreciate it if you share it around. And yeah, check out Beer Garden Tennis wherever you get your podcasts. Cheers, Kulfi.
Josh, I'm looking forward to talking to Struff. It's talking about Struffy. Hey, huge win in Munich. Struffy, we're coming for you. That's funny.